Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Where David Price-Jones makes a most welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Over the years, we've had David here on a number of occasions, and it's great to have him back on the occasion of the publication of his book, Fault Lines, a memoir, which has recently come out, and we got special copies over from London. Now, I should say thanks to King & Wood Mellisons for the use of this facility. But now I'm going to introduce our speaker. The topic tonight is From Closed Circle, which is an earlier David Price-Jones book, To Fault Lines, A Life. David Price-Jones was born in Vienna in 1936 and educated at Eton and Magdalen College, Oxford, where he read history. In the course of a literary career, he served as literary editor of the Financial Times and The Spectator, a war correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, and senior editor of National Review in the United States, as well as holding multiple academic positions. He is the author of 10 novels and 13 non-fiction books, and he and his wife Rebecca, who's here tonight, his wife Carissa, who's here tonight, live in London. And so, David, many thanks for talking on From Closed Circle to Fault Lines. Thank you.
Well, it looks as if I'm going to have to talk about myself.
You're an expert.
Yes. I don't think I know the subject too well. But I did do a very clever thing in choosing my parents. I chose two very remarkable people. And I owe them a great deal. They came from very different backgrounds. And I'll read you a tiny little moment, if I can find it here, in which I describe what was going on. Here they are, yes. This is how I summed up my family. Not quite Jewish and not quite Christian. Not quite Austrian and not quite French or English, not quite heterosexual and not quite homosexual, socially conventional but not quite secure, here were people not quite sure what their inheritance required of them. The Price-Joneses come from Newtown, Montgomery, which is a small place in the middle of Wales, and if you were to go there, you would find an enormous building with Price-Jones written in letters 20 foot high on the top of it. Because there was a character called Price, his first name, and Jones his last name, who was illegitimate in about 1830. It says in the parish registry, reputed father William Jones. And I once sat next to a local historian who said, do you mind that your ancestor was illegitimate? And I said, no, it seems a credit to him. And he said, well, I'm glad you said that, because I'm illegitimate. Price-Jones, we don't know how he managed it, but by the time he was 20, he already ran a chemist shop. Pretty soon afterwards, he started a cooperative for marketing wool. And he made a success of that, and it grew larger and larger, until in the end he was pretty well monopolising the wool trade in Wales. He employed 6,000 people in Newtown, which was an enormous number in those days, and he was obviously very inventive. He invented the sleeping bag of the Russian army, for example, which was a prototype of a sleeping bag, and he had the first mail order business in the world. He made himself an MP, a Member of Parliament, and the extraordinary thing was that in that part of the world where, on the whole, they're on the left, today they're all socialists, he was a Conservative Member of Parliament, which was very unusual, and the left rather dislike him. There's a left-wing historian called Henry Pelling who wrote an attack on Sir Price Jones, saying he ran a Welsh mafia, and he obviously did do something pretty audacious by getting the railway laid right up to the door of Price Jones, the Royal Welsh Warehouse. Henry Pelling says he went to Parliament with 16 Welsh MPs in his pocket. It may be so. In one of the hustings, he was hit on the head by a brick which had been thrown at him, and he was knocked out on the platform. And there followed a quite well-known case in England. They arrested the man who threw the brick, who proved to be the paid bodyguard of the agent of the Liberals. And the Liberals were the Hanbury Tracys. And the man who, Captain Lewis, who'd ordered the brick to be thrown, was arrested and sent to prison. And if you read the court reportings, which are really very enjoyable, I have them all, the judge says, "You will have heard the testimony of the scoundrel who threw the brick. And on the other hand, you will have heard the testimony of the honourable gentleman who has done more for this country than anyone else," and so on. So he goes to prison. And I was walking in my local little Welsh town, Bilth Wells, not so long ago, when a very old man came out from the clothing shop and said, "What's wrong with you, man?" So I said, "Mr. Meredith, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, why aren't you standing for Parliament?" So I said, "Do you think I should do?" So he said, "Oh, they were grand times. Your grandfather used to pay us 5 shillings to go and smash the Liberals' windows." So if you were at that huge big building, it really is enormous, if you were at the main entrance, you would see inserts into the brick wall. And on the left-hand side, it says, "Gold Prize, Vienna, 1873. Which is a rather surprising coincidence, because my other great-grandfather was in Vienna in 1873. The two of them, on both sides of my family, unknown to each other, were there. Now, Gustav Springer, the Viennese great-grandfather, he was the son of another illegitimate person, an orphan, who we think walked as a 12-year-old from Nuremberg to Vienna and got employed in Vienna. So by the time Gustav inherits from his father, he has some money. He works in a bank, and in 1873 is the big crash of the Austrian Stock Exchange. Gustav went in to buy, and there's testimony of the time, "This man is crazy. He's buying stock that's falling all the time." But of course, and that's what he was doing. He was the only person buying on the Vienna Stock Exchange. And there's a book about this by a man with a pseudonym called Comte Vasily. I don't know why. He's writing in French. I think he's a Russian journalist. And he says everybody's talking about Gustav Springer. But of course, a year later, what he bought for one was worth 100. He made an enormous fortune by speculating correctly on the stock exchange. And he is responsible for a quite well-known saying, which is, "Sell to the sound of cannons, buy to the sound, sell to the sound of violins, buy to the sound of cannons." So when things are going well, time to sell. Not many sellers now, are there? So, of course, what happens after powerful personalities like that is that it's very hard to follow their act. And what generally happens is that the children of self-made people, like both these great-grandfathers, try and hide. They go into the shadows. And that is partly what happened on the Price Jones side of the thing. He became an English gentleman. which is a pretty fatal thing to do if you're descended from a Welsh illegitimate child, because what it means is that his son just joined the British Army and spent his life as a professional soldier, and didn't do anything much more than just hide in the shadows. He was a very brave soldier. He was sent to the South African War, and he got the DSO at a famous encounter, the Modder River, when the British Army, as usual, had made a mess of it. And they'd left their guns on one side of the Modder River, and where the Boers were, and they were on the other side of the Modder River. So my poor grandfather had to go and help rescue the guns, and he got the DSO for it. And I eventually, when I did my military service, I joined the same Coast Guards regiment, and we were trooping the Queen's colour, and it was a very big ceremony, and I was hidden at the back of it, thank God, and I suddenly heard my name on the loudspeaker. It was absolutely terrifying. There were 3,000 guardsmen on parade, and I froze, and everybody knew that I was about to be arrested and sent to prison. The question was, what had I done? And two drill sergeants came and marched me right across the parade ground to the general commanding the whole parade, General Sir Charles Lloyd. And he leant forward and said, "I'm so glad you're here. I got my DSO with your grandfather, Harry. I'm so glad you're here. Please, we'll have lunch together after this parade." You can imagine my heart was, you know, practically dying of fright. And everybody knew that I'd had it, but all I actually had was lunch. Now, my Grandpa Harry was seconded to the very amazing post, which was he was a lieutenant in the Northern Nigeria Frontier Battalion. That meant he had to go to Nigeria, and he was the only white man in hundreds of square miles. And he set off on foot with 18 bearers from one particular tribe and 16 bearers from another particular tribe. And there came a moment in the middle of nowhere where the people who lived in the middle of nowhere come out and make trouble. And they fire arrows. And one of the arrows goes through Grandpa Harry's servant's hat. And he writes to his mother in Wales saying, describing the scene, as there's the sentence, "I dropped a man at 80 yards." I had some hesitation whether to put that in, because obviously he can be made to be the usual imperialist criminal, British murderer, etc., etc. But they'd been attacked, and they had to defend themselves, and that was what happened. But it was curious to write to his mother that sentence, "I dropped a man at 80 yards." He was a very good shot, by the way. And I suppose that was with a rifle. Anyhow, there he was. And in the First World War, he was in the trenches for 2 years. The next generation, of course, after the person who's become gentrified, what do they do? And this is a very well-known sort of triad. Self-made man, the hide-and-seeker, the aesthete. My father was a very gifted man. He wrote very well. He played the piano. He could almost to professional standards. And he lived a quite different life from his own father or his own grandfather. It was cosmopolitan. He was not at all afraid to be himself. And he goes to Vienna for the music and the study and so on. 1930, he must have been about 26. Now, and there he meets my mother. Now, on the Springer side of the thing, because Gustav Springer came from an orphan and had made all this money, he founded and ran and financed the Springer Waisenhaus, the orphanage, for, the Jewish orphanage for boys. There was another separate Jewish orphanage for girls, but he did the Jewish orphanage for boys. And I think that my grandmother, whose name was Mitzi, and my mother also, and her two sisters and her brother, the whole lot thought of themselves as assimilated Jews. They were very confident that they were just like other people. And they behaved like other people, with, I suppose, a tiny exception, that they used to go to the Jewish orphanage and that there was a synagogue there. And on the whole, it was a light-hearted thing. I mean, there was a story of my father going to a service there and forgot to bring a hat. And the hat that was offered to him was much too big, and it kept on falling over his ears, and everybody roaring with laughter because he was being so clumsy with the hat. It doesn't suggest a very religious thing, does it? So they married in 1934, and I'm born in 1936. And, of course, he has British nationality, and my mother acquires British nationality, which was just as well, because March 1938, it's the Anschluss. My father, they weren't there. They were in the house that you will see on the front cover of the book, Fault Lines. That is in France. And I suppose I should say that they were all extremely rich. I mean, Gustav had left them an enormous fortune. My grandmother, Mitzi, must have been one of the richest women in Europe. And taxation and inflation weren't quite what they now seem so punishing as they do to us. Gustav, it's hard to estimate his fortune, but it's in modern terms, it's hundreds of millions of euros. And that's only what you can see. I mean, he kept on buying property in Hungary and Czechoslovakia. His view of investing was Grund fliegt nimmer weg, land never flies away. But of course he was wrong about that, because it did. It started flying away after 1938. They couldn't have ever escaped history. So the Gestapo arrived in the house in January 1940. They took everything. There's a list of 52 pictures that the Gestapo took on January the 15th, 1940. And on January the 16th, 1940, the head of the Art Commission in Austria writes to the Gestapo saying, "Where is the Van Dyck? We had it yesterday and it's gone today." So what it means is that one of the Gestapo men decided to steal from the other Gestapo men, and that picture, which was a Van Dyck, has never turned up. In 1999, I got a letter from the Belvedere Museum in Vienna, because the law had changed and they had to give back stolen property. And I got a letter to say they had a picture and had it on exhibition since 1943 in the Belvedere, and they were now forced by law to return it. It took 11 years for them to do it. There was always some extra reason why they couldn't quite return it. But when it turned up, after 11 years in 2010, that very same day I got a letter from the director of the Belvedere Museum. The picture shows a Hungarian shepherd boy by an Austrian artist called Raffald. It's not a valuable picture, but it's very charming. And the director of the Belvedere said it was important in the history of Austria because it was a Hungarian subject, and it was their equivalent of Orientalism, and etc., etc. And would I like to return the picture? My answer was altogether two lines. Now, when my parents, when we had to leave Vienna, Eichmann came. Adolf Eichmann was in charge of the deportation, and he rounded up all the orphanage all the staff of the orphanage, and some were sent to Theresienstadt and some were sent to Auschwitz. And the only one who ever came back was the daughter of the director, Frau Margulies. She was the only one who came back. All the others were murdered. And they took her. They took the building of the orphanage and turned it into an old people's home for Jewish people too unwell to be deported for a bit. And then they were all deported after about a year. And then it was considered abandoned property. And the municipality of Vienna, quite according to the law, appropriated the building, knocked it down and built housing all over it. And after the war said, well, everything was done according to the law, and they didn't compensate the Jewish community or anybody. And that was the story of the end of the orphanage. Frau Margulies came back, and she had had an extraordinary war. She'd been, I forget, I think it was something like 13 concentration camps, because they had had her down as a cook. She wasn't a cook, but they had her down as a cook. And so they sent her with a special SS detachment from one concentration camp to another to cook. And that's how she survived. And she wrote a book which has not been published, but it was a moving thing, to describe how she'd been in the Yugoslavia camp, and she'd been in Westerbork in Holland and in Drancy in Paris. And imagine her going with a detachment of SS people from one camp to another. It's almost unthinkable, isn't it? So comes the war. My father, who speaks very good German, he'd spent the last year of peace learning Czech. And he joins the intelligence service. I always used to say to him, come on, you know perfectly well you were a spy. And he would say, I don't remember. And I never could get him to tell me exactly what he was doing. But in February 1940, he was sent to Cambridge to do an intelligence course. And my mother went back to England as well, and that left me in France, in this house Royaumont, which you see on the cover of the book. And it's the most beautiful and wonderful house. And I'm looked after by my nanny. My nanny was called Jessie Wheeler, and she was born in 1873, and also, like everybody else, winning their gold medals. And she'd been my mother's nanny. And she was... And say straight away, I mean, I wouldn't be here if she hadn't looked after me. She was a wonderful figure. She came from a very humble background. Her father was a carpenter in Oxford. She was one of seven children, and they had between them three pairs of shoes. So you could only go to school when the shoes fitted your feet. And she wasn't really educated, but she had in her head an enormous amount of Shakespeare and poetry and songs and quotations and one thing and another. And she was the salt of the earth. So comes a moment in May 1940 when the Blitzkrieg starts. My grandmother was then married to... My grandfather had long since died, and she was then married to a man called Frank Worcester, who was English and was not Jewish. And... to cut a long story short, they made their way by car out of France while the going was good, and they went to Lisbon while the going was good. And about two or three weeks after they'd left, my uncle Max, my mother's elder brother, comes to the house and says, "We've all got to go. It's not the Germans are coming." So. Who's we? It was Max, his elder sister, my mother's elder sister, Bubbles, as she was called. Her real name was Hélène. Her husband, Eduardo. their two children and their nanny, and me and my nanny. So we were in two cars from the Spanish embassy with the Spanish flag flying. Why? Because Eduardo was the second secretary in the Spanish embassy. And he was a very reactionary, conservative man, not a fascist, but a monarchist. And he knew all these people like Laval and all this because that was his job. So we set off on the Great Exodus on the day when all the French government is also setting off on the road. My earliest memory is of being in this big black car pressing through a throng of people and people staring in through the window asking, who the hell are you? And we reached Bordeaux. And when we reached Bordeaux, Eduardo found that the Spanish consulate was shut and the Spanish consul had done a runner. And there were about 1,500 people begging for visas to go to Spain. You could only get a transit visa to go through Spain in Madrid. So this was a catch-22 situation. They didn't want to give any visas. Eduardo gave 1,500 visas. The Spanish foreign minister was Serrano Suñer, who was Franco's brother-in-law, who thought that Hitler should win the war and would win the war. He immediately sacked Eduardo for giving these visas. Eduardo's name, by the way, is now at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. He's considered one of the righteous Gentiles, of whom there are four Spanish righteous Gentiles. He's one of them. So Eduardo then has charge of me. And he must have given me false papers. I don't have the false papers, unfortunately. I wish I did. But eventually, to cut a long story short, we spent some time in Cannes, in the south of France, where Max had rented a house. And then we go to Spain. I remember very clearly in Spain, playing on the beach at Zarauz, on the northern coast of Spain, and Jesse sitting on a bench next to me, and I would run up this concrete ramp, and suddenly there's a German soldier sitting next to her. And German soldiers were allowed to wear uniform in Franco, Spain, but not allowed to carry sidearms. So here's a German soldier, and Jesse turns to him and says, very, very loudly, do you think I'm going to sit on a bench next to you? Get off this bench. And he, I'm sure, didn't understand English. But he saw a very angry old lady and thought it was a bench reserved for English nannies or something. He saluted and went away. And I knew we were going to win the war. I'm going to just read you, because it gives you the whole character of Jess, a tiny little extract of a letter that she wrote to my mother. This is a woman, as I told you, uneducated. Hitler is neither master of the seas nor the skies, but until he is, invasion is bound to failure. The awe-inspiring courage of the British people, wrote W. Lippmann in the New York Herald Tribune in September, could not be sustained if, along with their brave hearts, they did not also have clear heads. They fight on and are determined to fight back, not in the manner of men resisting blindly, but as men who know their position and odds and real alternatives. Only a great people could do this. The British are a great people, and now they are led by a man who knows their history, and having the quality of greatness and being greatly led, their reason does not undermine, but on the contrary strengthens the courage of their hearts. That, I think, will give you her character. Now, my grandmother had to go to get papers for her properties in Hungary, and she went to the German embassy, where there was business to be done, which was obviously very embarrassing to be a Jewish lady going to the German embassy. And then she goes to the Hungarian legation. And the minister in the Hungarian legation, when she comes into the room, stands up and says, congratulations. And my grandma says, what on? And he says, well, don't you know? Know what? Your horse has just won the Budapest Derby. I think that must be pretty unique in refugee history. That the refugee can actually win the house. So she couldn't go to Hungary because she was Jewish, but her horse could win the Derby. And she describes it in her diary, and she describes the sad end of the horse, that her stud in Hungary was a place called Leshvar. And we went to Leshvar. It was all ruin. And when the Red Army came, a Russian major said, "I want to ride that horse." And they said, "Well, don't, because it can only fit a racing saddle, and a racing saddle is very uncomfortable unless you're used to it." And he said, I know how to deal with that." He got on the horse. The horse immediately threw him. He drew his revolver and shot it. So my grandmother went off to Canada. My father goes to Bletchley, and he characterised Bletchley, where they were listening to the German traffic, of course. He characterises it in a very memorable sentence. He said, "Bletchley was a place where the office boys quoted T.S. Eliot and whistled themes from Bartok." And I'm sure he did a very good intelligence job. And his name crops up here and there in the books, dealing with intelligence matters and the battle order of the German army, which was his speciality. And I go with Eduardo and Bubbles and their two children, my cousins, to where he was sent, which was Morocco. He sent to a fishing village called La Roche on the Moroccan coast, and there I find myself. So I have very happy memories of arriving in Morocco, because in Cannes, in the south of France, we didn't have papers, Jesse and I. We didn't have food. And so I had to rely on what Jesse could provide. And Jesse and I were a good little team of thieves. We went into other people's gardens and pulled up their vegetables. And Jesse would find somewhere through the hedge or through the fence and say, "Go on in there, go on, get the carrots." And I have nothing but happy memories. It seemed a perfectly normal thing to do. But looking back on it, perhaps it wasn't really. But we were very hungry and until we got to Morocco, and then we could eat. I have been hungry, and I remember the sensation of it, and it's very uncomfortable. Funnily enough, it makes you want to cry. It's a horrid feeling, and I hope never to have to feel it again. I went with Clarissa back to the house where we were in Tangier, because you couldn't live in La Roche. There wasn't any housing, really. It was just shacks. Eduardo found this house in Tangier, and there was a witch doctor sat at the entrance of the house, and she had orange feet. It was wonderfully exciting, and she was blessing and cursing people, and I would play football with the little Arab boys, and I went back with Clarissa in 1968, and there was the same gardener, Mohamed Driss, who I'd played with when I was six. And he came to chase us out, and he recognized me and started weeping, and I wept too. It was a very moving moment. But I think it governs my feelings about the Arabs, really, that I owe Morocco a lot. The next-door house to us in Tangier belonged to the Glaoui, who was a Berber chieftain. And I can remember the savage sound of music, this Arab Berber music that would come from that house. So I don't have feelings of enmity towards the Arabs, on the contrary. And that's been a nice thing. I wanted to find out about the Arab world. And my literary life, really, I think, everything that I've written has been trying to get at why people believe the things they do believe. I mean, rationality is obviously common to the whole human race. Logic is common to the whole human race. How come these people do irrational and illogical things? And that's what I was trying to answer when I wrote The Closed Circle. It's not rational to go to a war that you are destined to lose. And they keep on repeating that. And having had it proved to them they're going to lose, they do it again. And I also couldn't really believe the communists were the way they were. I could just understand that Nazis wanted to a racial solution of the thing, that they believed that they were racially superior to everybody else, in spite of the fact that they obviously weren't. How come people do believe the amazing things that they have in their heads? And that's what my novels are about, and that's really what The Close Circle is about. I went to live in Haifa in Israel in 1962 with Clarissa and my eldest daughter, and I got to know Israel in what now seems the Garden of Eden paradise that it was then. Although it was enclosed and you couldn't easily travel into the Arab world, you had to go through Cyprus. But I'm glad I saw that, because it was very Spartan and very cohesive. I got to know quite a lot of Arab people there as well. One of my close friends is a Christian Arab called Atala Mansour. And I knew Rashid Hussein, quite a good Palestinian poet. I used to go to his house, which he shared with his mother. And I never met the mother. And you would see a little bony hand come around with a bowl of food at the level of the floor, because she was in the kitchen cooking, and she wouldn't come and see us and let us see her. And yet he was quite a sophisticated, you know, he'd read all the stuff that people read, and yet he behaved in this very antique manner. I wrote a book about this is Israeli experience. And when NASA then in 1967 moved into the Sinai Desert, I went to the Telegraph and I said, there's going to be a war. And I went every day into the Telegraph to tell, and there was a wonderful editor there called John Ansley. And he said, well, if you know so much about it, off you go. And so I went, and I arrived in time for the war, and I covered the Six-Day War for the Telegraph. And again, I had a kind of epiphany, I think is the word, when something happens that really registers with you. I was driving in a hire car towards the Golan Heights, because it was obvious that that was where the Israeli next assault was coming. And I passed a battery of heavy artillery. They were hidden in a eucalyptus grove, under eucalyptus trees. Huge guns firing a shell 20-25 miles. Big howitzers. And the ground was shaking. And I got out of the car and looked at this. And I thought to myself, if those little boys from the Springer Waisenhaus, from the orphanage, had been able to call on these gunners, they wouldn't have died. And that remains with me an important element of my character. I wrote a book about the Palestinians because it was obvious that no good was going to come from the PLO. I remember hearing Yasser Arafat make a speech on the West Bank. I think it was near Jenin. And he was urging the people on to fight. And I just thought, well, what's actually going to happen is that most of these people who are listening to what he's going to say are going to have to lose their lives because it's not going to work. And he's been responsible, I think, for blackening the name of Israel and producing a lot of propaganda against Israel, which is all meaningless and bad. And, of course, he's been joined in that enterprise by others, notably Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, eventually, I wrote The Close Circle to put together all my experiences of the Arabs. I think I've been to all the Arab countries except Saudi Arabia, I never got to Libya either. I was going to get a visa to Libya. I was going for the Telegraph. And while I was actually talking to the man who issues the visas, the British Foreign Office were on the line, and the man on the other end was telling the Libyan consul, don't give Price Jones a visa, he's dangerous. It's not made me very fond of the Foreign Office, I have to say.
David, we may get you to break soon and we'll take some questions.
Sir, I needn't go on with fault lines because I've told you everything there is in fault lines.
That's okay.
But I will close by with just this observation, which is that Arabs have come to me and said, you say very hard things about us, but you say them in a way which we can tell you wish us well, not that you wish us ill.
Let's go around the back of you.
Okay.
So now we come to questions and discussion. Janet Grundy's got copies of Fault Lines, David Price Jones. I'm sure David would be happy to sign mine after. They'll probably do the signing here. Thanks again to King and Wood Mellisons. I understand a few people have been involved in bringing you out here. Professor Claudio Velez and the Conversazione down at La Trobe University, I think in Melbourne, Quadrant Magazine in Sydney, Australian Israel and Jewish Affairs Council in Melbourne and in Sydney, and here you are at the Sydney Institute, and your book is ready. So we've got to the top of the hour, and then I think a few of us will have to go home and guard our vegetable patches in case David and Clarissa come around pinching the carrots. So I'll be heading out the door right at the top of the hour. So we've got to be pretty quick. We've got a lot of people here, and we've got about 20 minutes. So tell us a bit about your life. I mean, I think Anne mentioned to you the other night. I remember reading Nigel Nicholson's book, A Portrait of a Marriage, and I thought he was pretty lucky to be around since his father was a homosexual and his mother was a lesbian. Mm. But you're sort of pretty lucky to be around because your father was a homosexual, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean...
Come back in.
I had that sentence not quite heterosexual, not quite... He was both these things. I'm not an expert in the matter, but aren't people possibly bisexual sometimes, occasionally, now and then, this one and that one? My father was a delightful man. He was very amusing and very quick and intelligent. He was very well read. He had a sad life, of course, because my mother died when she was 37. She had cancer, and cancer of the liver. And there was nothing to be done about it. Probably would still be the same today, wouldn't it? I mean, liver cancers are pretty fatal. And so my father found himself alone, and he went off to America. And yes, there certainly is a shady side of his life about which I don't know much. But in America, he married a lady from Texas, and she died in the same American hospital in Paris as my mother. And after that, Alan lived entirely with a young man. There he was.
So we've got a question here.
Are you saying that Arafat's legacy is still the dominant influence in a lot of Arab or Palestinian thought processes?
Yes, I am saying that, and I think it's he believed in confrontation. He was not ever going to compromise, and he knew perfectly well that if you can take an inch, you can also take a yard. And he has set his people on the road of violence instead of on the road of compromise. So why is that? And the answer is, again, I am pretty convinced about it, the argument I put in the closed circle, it's to do with shame and honour, that it's shameful to make peace with the Jews whom you despise. And since the Jews are not fighting people, but they're second-class citizens in the Arab society, you can't possibly give them anything. And Arafat set them on this course. There were and are lots of people on the West Bank who understand that perfectly well, and lots of people in Gaza who understand that perfectly well. But if they try to do anything about it, they're for it. They will be punished and possibly killed.
Richard?
David, can you tell us what you think about the consequences to flow from this enormous Muslim migration from the Middle East into Europe?
I think we can't deny the fact that there's a big demographic change. We don't know how many Muslims there are in Europe because censuses don't ask for your religion. And there are enormous numbers of illegal immigrants. When Spain, about 10 years ago, had an amnesty for illegal immigrants, they were very surprised to discover that there were 700 170,000 illegal immigrants who applied for the amnesty. That was an enormous number that took them completely by surprise. We don't know how many there are in France or Germany or Italy. They can land in little bays and coves and little ships, and nobody knows. And then they disappear into the background. So it's probably there are 20 million, maybe 30, and some say 40 million. So the demographic change must have some consequence. As we speak, there are hundreds arriving still every day, and the authorities have no idea what to do about it. It's they didn't expect it, and they're caught between consternation and fear. They're so afraid that we, the natives, will turn on these people, that they give us a completely false picture of reality. The thing that frightens them most of all, I mean, I think especially in France and Germany, is a backlash, that suddenly the lads are going to take it into their heads to go and kill some Muslims since they come and kill us. It hasn't happened, and perhaps it won't happen, but the authorities are not telling us really the way it is. The authorities, all they can think about, really, is appeasement. They must make life. If you're very, very nice to the Muslims, maybe they will be less nasty to you, which is not a very satisfactory situation. So we have incremental changes all the time. You have such extraordinary things as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, telling us that Sharia law is desirable and should be imposed. This very week, the British ambassador in Saudi Arabia announces that he's converted to Islam. So the Muslim world is up in arms with joy, of course. I mean, it's wonderful for them to say, their top men become Muslims. Look at that. It's the right thing. Come on, join, or else be killed. And if they build an alternate society, a different society with Sharia and their own customs, and they impose themselves on the natives, I think the worst has to be expected. It will be, as some people are already predicting, blood in the streets. Meanwhile, the effect that is already happening is that because the conservative elements in all these countries have not known what to do, it's opened the political space to far-right parties. They're not exactly fascist, not exactly Nazi, but they're sort of quasi-fascist, quasi-Nazi. And there are some unsavory characters in all these countries who, if it comes to it, would behave extremely violently against the Muslims. We have to hope that that doesn't happen, that the Muslims get integrated. How you integrate the Muslims, nobody can tell us. And we'll have to see if it can happen.
Tell us about your the book you wrote, Paris and the Third Reich, I think, where you read French, I imagine.
It was my first language.
Yes, it was. but I think that book was very successful in English. I read it in English, but because you were dealing with the collaboration between the French intelligentsia and the German authorities, and also the Vichy authorities in Paris and in the Vichy zone further south, it was what censored. So what was the experience of being censored in your first language by, 30 years ago?
It was a very odd experience indeed. I wrote this book about the German occupation, and I was given a pretty hefty advance by a French publisher, as well as, of course, Hoh Reinhardt, who was where it began. And I wrote the book. And it was 150,000 words, and they were very pleased with it in Paris, and they translated it and sent me the translation. The translation was awful. I flew to Paris and said to the publisher, "This is terrible. Look." He said, "Yes, it's terrible. We'll have another translation." So we had another translation, and that was very good. And I was due to appear on Cinq-Colonne à la Une, which is the French literary TV programme. And what was he called? Patrick Poivre was going to interview me, who was, again, big shot in France in those days. And about 4 weeks before the book was due to be published and I was to appear on television, The publisher rings me up and says, I'm very sorry, we can't publish your book. The government won't have it. There's been an objection to your book, and I'm not going to fight for it, because if I did, I'd lose my firm, and I'm not prepared to sacrifice my firm for you. You can keep your advance, the translators can keep their advance, and we're writing the whole thing off. And I've never found out which... It must be very high up. It must be someone in the government who had the power to suppress the book. And it turned out that at the back of a French book, if you look at them, there's a what they call a bon à tirage, a certificate that you may print. I thought that was to do with printing, and it was just some kind of... But it's not. It's not a... It is the authorization of the government that you may print the book. So the French press is not actually free.
Ida.
Thank you very much.
Ida.
Thank you so much for such an interesting presentation. How do you think that we in the West should be dealing with the rise of dangerous Islamic extremism?
How should we be dealing with dangerous Islamic
extremism?
Well, we have to resist it. There's no alternative. If you don't resist it, you will increase it. They must be given no excuses. And that is why I'm against appeasement and why I'm for taking a tough line. It requires a great deal of intelligence work. And of course, what you have to get is double and triple agents whom you can rely on. You have to get very shady characters and bribe them and make it worth their while. It's possible to do so. I mean, the Israelis had the son of the chief of Hamas. The Israelis also had the son-in-law of Nasser. Marwan Asrar. Perhaps I mean Sadat, do I? Yes, I think he was the son-in-law of Sadat. But anyhow, this is how you deal with these people. You have got to get inside knowledge of what they're doing. And this is not easy. And I don't think we have enough people with the language skills and the character to pass themselves off as being Islamic extremists while telling us what they're doing. This is a hard demand, but it's the only way to do it. And there has to be proper punishment. And we don't properly punish people, but the United States does. I mean, Abu Hamza, the man with the hook and one eye, if you remember, he was responsible for a great deal of terror. It took us 8 years to deport him to the United States, where he got a life sentence, which he'll serve. Why is the British law so feeble? And I hope that Mrs. May will tighten it up.
Peter.
David, you are a man with roots in Great Britain and in Europe. From your perspective, how do you think Brexit is going to change the character of Great Britain?
Well, I feel myself to be extremely British. I'm not English. I'm Price Jones' side, as you know, is Welsh. But British is a real thing. It's a proper identity. And it comprises the Scots and the Welsh, and it used to comprise all the Irish, but now it's only part of the Irish. But it's a real thing. And I think we've made a contribution to history. I don't feel that I'm an imperialist, warmongering criminal, which is what the left would like to depict me as. And as a matter of fact, that's how the close circle was received in the Arab world. They said this warmongering, imperialist, criminal, Zionist, has written this book about the Arabs. And he says, and then there followed a 1,000-word extract from my book. So it's a rave reviews, as you can imagine. But I think what it will do is put us in touch with what we have achieved in the past, which was really freedom. The Brits are good at freedom. Never, never shall be slaves. And I was a Brexit man myself because I don't see what I have to gain by being ordered around by foreigners who I can't make accountable. I get instructions b- b- by the thousand from Brussels of what I'm allowed to do, eat, think, move, etc. Who are these people? And why are they giving me orders when I can't do anything to alter those or make them accountable? So I was always a keen Brexit man, and I think, in fact, what it will do is liberate the energies of our nation. And I think it will be an example for the whole of Europe. My experience now is that everybody is saying, if only we had the strength and courage of the Brits, you are lucky to have got out, you know. We go to Italy a lot, and all the Italians who ever meet throw their hands up and say, God, if only we could do the same. It's no fun to be ruled by other people. Look at the American election and what we know about Trump and Clinton and how that's gone on. We know everything, don't we? And the European presidential election, there was a voter list of 17 people. They went into a closed room. We don't know who proposed who, nor why they proposed. We don't know how they voted. We will never know how they voted. The curtains part, and out comes Mr. Juncker as the president of Europe. I'd never heard of my president. He gives me orders, and there's nothing I can do to counteract him. Do I want that? No, I don't. And that's not a way to choose your president. So I think all the stuff about how we would be poor is nonsense. It's the sixth largest economy in the world. The Brits are pretty inventive. They have a pretty good education system. Quite a number of us are piratical too. We're going to go out and conquer. The Scots are wonderful businessmen. And I don't think that's been dispensed with. So I have every hope that it will be really work out for the best. I also happen to think that the EU was constructed in the wrong way, that they thought that an economic union would be the way to do it. And it depends on abolishing the nation state, which is never going to happen. And therefore the whole thing will actually pretty soon collapse. And when it collapses, we'll be able to stand to one side and wave goodbye.
Final question.
David, I've finished your book. It's wonderful. But it reminds me very much of your cousin's book, The Hare with the Amber Eyes, in that you've managed to trace so much of the 20th century through the connections of a particular family and a family group. Could you, in summary, just say what you think it's given to us in the sense of how we look back on that time, which the other night when I spoke to you about it, you said, and it's all gone. So what's gone?
Well, what's gone was the Central European civilization, which was very good. It was extremely progressive in its way. I regret the Habsburg Empire. There were 16 components, 16 national components in the Habsburg Empire. So when the orders were given by the officers in German, but the men spoke Ruthenian and Romanian and Serbocrat, they never understood the orders. It was a very nice, ramshackle, cosy arrangement. And it would have gone on forever. Wasn't it better to have gentle old Kaiser, rather than the Gestapo and all the rest of it? It seems to me that what we've lost is a certain civility. We've lost confidence that if you look at the pre-1914 world that was happening, many very wonderful, creative and original people who have to run for their lives. Look at the number of gifted Germans and Austrians who either were killed or fled to America. America was able to take great advantage of all this. And in a way, America and perhaps Australia, there's sort of an after-echo of European culture, but it's not the thing that it used to be. They sat in cafes writing masterpieces, didn't they? If you read some books, it's almost too painful. I mean, the letters that Stefan Zweig and Joseph Roth exchanged, in which they talk about the situation and what they're about to lose. And Joseph Roth says, this is real, you must understand, this is serious, it's you they've got in their sights. And it was true, they did. So I think it's made us all look on the human race with slightly less ardour and pleasure. The human race can do very nasty things.
Many thank you. Many thanks. Well, it's always great to have David Price Jones at the Sydney Institute. I'm pleased you could come and talk about your most recent book, Fault Lines, which, as Anne points out, I mean, it's really a study of European history from the end of the 19th century on, but looking through the history through the eyes of a family and the development of a family and the changes of a family, which is your family. So it's a wonderful book. Congratulations. And no doubt you'll be back again since you come to Australia on a regular basis. But for tonight, well done. And as I said, there'll be copies to be signed by David up here. Janet's got them over there. But for tonight, congratulations and well done.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Yeah.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.